Hi, I'm Logan Medish, your host of the High Caliber History Podcast, and on this episode of the show, my guest and I are going to take a look at one of the biggest bits of folklore surrounding the M16 and its use in Vietnam. I guarantee you're going to enjoy this show. Stay tuned, I hope you like it. Hi everyone, my guest on the show this evening is Martin K.A. Morgan, who is an author and historian who specializes in American and military history. With a background as a park ranger and a museum professional, he has been leading battlefield tours around the world since 2002. He's the author of two World War II books, and he contributes to more than half a dozen magazines. Since 2015, he has served as the historical consultant and technical advisor with Sledgehammer Games and Activision on the ever-popular game series Call of Duty. And if his face looks familiar, it's because you've probably seen him on one of the many programs on PBS, Discovery, National Geographic, History, The Weather Channel, Sci-Fi, Oxygen, The Outdoor Channel, The Smithsonian Channel, The Science Channel, and The American Heroes Channel. With all of that, you might be thinking that the KA stands for kick ass in his initials, but it doesn't. He's just Marty to me. He's just my good friend Marty. So Marty, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. I'm glad that that Oxygen Channel quote got in there. That's my biggest pride, being on the Oxygen Channel.
as it should be, the Oxygen Channel, and then followed neatly after by the Weather Channel, right?
Yeah, Weather Channel of all strange things did that too.
Yeah, that is a strange one. How did you end up on the Weather Channel, and what was that?
I've done a couple of Weather Channel shows. One was about weather and D-Day, which is sort of an obvious connection with me.
Okay.
The less obvious connection was because during Hurricane Katrina in 2005, right, I lived in downtown New Orleans, and I recorded 18 hours of footage before, during, and after the hurricane.
Oh, wow.
That kind of captured a moment in time that was unique and special. And I had a perspective of being right there in the middle of things, six blocks from the Superdome, six blocks from the river during Katrina. And they did a retrospective about the hurricane and used some of my footage and used interviews with me in it.
Oh.
I didn't expect that role, but I had that one.
Gotcha. That's pretty cool. Well, let's go to something a little more pertinent to us before we delve into the meat and potatoes of what we're doing here. Just to get a little bit of a background, where did your love of history and firearms come from, and which came first? Was it the guns or the history?
It was the history came first. The guns came almost despite my interests, because my father was a U.S. Army officer, and I was born on a U.S. Army post and lived on them until I was in my teens. And my grandfather had been in the Second World War, and my uncle had been in the Second World War. And I was around them a lot when I was a kid. Also with my father on active duty from the time I was a kid until the time I was a teenager, I was raised around not just him, but also his men. So I was around U.S. Army soldiers. We lived in U.S. Army housing. And that invested me with an interest in history right off the bat. Like, I grew up in a house at 7 Midway Lane near Eaton, New Jersey, that was obviously named after the Battle of Midway. And I was living there in 1977 when the movie Midway came out.
Oh, wow.
And it was a bit of a perfect storm. And the late 1970s was just one awesome World War II movie after the other. Things like Midway, Bridge Too Far, The Big Red One. And I got kind of addicted to that kind of movie.
Okay.
My father had what we would describe as a less than positive experience in Vietnam, which I think could be said for basically everyone that went there.
Yeah, just about.
And yeah, he didn't really have a great time in Vietnam. And he was dead set opposed to me or my brother shooting firearms. And so it, I think, caused him a lot of heartburn and concern that by the time I was about 12 or 13, after my enthusiasm for Princess Leia kind of faded, I really got interested in firearms in the early 80s and wanted a firearm. I wanted actually a 1911 A1 for my 12th birthday, and because that's what 12-year-olds should have.
Oh, absolutely.
And definitely. And he wouldn't get me an actual 1911, but he got me one of these. It was a company called Collector's Armory, imported these non-functioning dummy guns. And I got one of those to pacify me. And I guess he thought that that would pacify me enough to where the interest would go away. And then the following year, I just wanted a rifle, and it's just been downhill ever since in terms of firearms ownership and enthusiasm, despite my father's attempts to steer me in another direction.
Well, you know, it could have been guns or it could have been drugs. You know, I would argue that this is probably the more expensive of the two hobbies, really.
It didn't used to be, but it is now, isn't it? Gosh, yeah. I remember I look back to, I was basically born, I think, 5 years too late for it to have been perfect timing. But okay. If I had been born 5 years earlier, I would have been at the point of buying things at a time when everything was abundant and inexpensive. I would have been buying things instead of starting to buy in like 87, I would have been buying in 82. And that's an important threshold, because then that would have meant I could have cashed in on the first big round of import stuff.
Yeah.
Because I got very interested in pre-89 assault rifles and have developed a bit of a collection for them. And although it started too late, but that the interest in firearms picked up basically as a consequence of an existing interest in history. Like my dad, when he was in the Army, he was he had to do these PME courses, these professional military educational courses, and that resulted in me getting dragged to every battlefield you could ever imagine, from from the Revolution to the Civil War. And it's just been a lifelong interest, both history and firearms, ever since.
Very cool. Well, there's certainly worse ways to get into it.
I think so too. It's like, I've never been a hunter. And I competed in shooting until my eyesight went, and I'm still interested in it. And I still shoot, but just not like it used to be. And there's plenty of room in the hobby for all of these different interests: people that are hunting, people that are competitive shooting, and then people that have more of an historically focused interest like I do.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and talking history, let's bring it back to Vietnam. You can't talk about Vietnam and not talk about the M16. For all of its fanfare and its faults, you can't talk that war without the M16. And of course, we've got the three big players, of course, Colt, and we've got Harrington and Richardson, and GM Hydromatic. But then there's a fourth manufacturer that comes up fairly frequently. And I know I've encountered it in giving museum tours and having Vietnam vets on my tours. And I know you have encountered far more of it than I have, both in working in gun shops and giving battle tours throughout the world. But for those who don't know where we're going with this, it's that Vietnam vet who comes up to you at the end of the tour and he says, you know, when I got into the service, they handed me an M16, and right there on the lower receiver, it said Mattel. And you think to yourself, Mattel, the toy company, the California toy company, Mattel? And you're like, no, that can't be. But they are adamant that they were issued an M16 that said Mattel. And I learned very quickly not to argue with them about it, because it's certainly not going to get me anywhere, and I'm certainly not going to change their mind. So where in the world does the Mattel M16 concept come from? Where is this idea infiltrating their minds? How do they get their wires so crossed with this?
I think it all derived from a product that Mattel actually did make, which was a toy firearm called the M16 Marauder. As you have correctly already stated, and as you correctly comprehend, the Mattel toy company had absolutely, positively nothing to do with production of the M16 rifle. I've actually even observed a process of negotiation with the mythology over the last 30 years or so of my life, insofar as I've heard people assert that Mattel made M16s. I've heard it thousands of times. And then I would push back with statements like, well, you know, there's absolutely no documentation whatsoever to indicate that the Mattel Toy Company was involved in production of the rifle. And then people, through this negotiation that I'm identifying, they would say, well, they didn't make rifles, but they made furniture, suggesting that buttstock pistol grip and four ends for M16s were made by the company, because people would then testify to having seen the Mattel logo on the plastic components of the weapon, which that is also completely untrue. And what I believe happened, and what I have is a theory, but I feel like it's a pretty darn good theory. And I believe that my theory is a good one because of the fact that I've got a little bit of evidence to support the idea. And the evidence that I have is that there was use of these toy rifles in motion pictures and even by the military itself. So the Mattel Marauder, which coincidentally I had one as a kid, which I wish I had it to display here tonight, but of course I completely destroyed it.
You were in service in the jungles of New Jersey with it, right?
Right. And that is where I had it too. And in fact, and it got destroyed on post at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, in one of the housing areas, because me and my friends, I wrecked that gun. And it's too bad I don't have one now. And I keep looking at them because I feel like having one for moments like this would be useful, because I could I can do things like, here's my clone Mattel M16A1 that I built, and it would be useful to have a toy. But the toys now were more costly than it took to make this. The Mattel Marauders are so absurdly expensive now that I just haven't done it, because it kind of just feels galling to spend that much money on a toy just for the sake of this discussion. Right. But what I now know is, and what we all know, is that the Mattel Marauders, these were toy guns. They're distinctive and easily recognizable because they're scaled down. They're like a 75% scale of an actual M16A1. Some of the dimensions on them aren't true to the M16A1. And then the magazine is the most noticeable part, because it's really thick, and it's because they had a little speaker in them. And when you pulled the trigger, that speaker would provide simulated sounds of gunfire. And as a kid, it was the best toy ever, but it was it was made of injection molded plastic, and it could not survive the kid test, because I remember that within the first few months I had destroyed the audio function, so that speaker was done, and then the gun lived on, but part by part was breaking as the years went by, and then eventually it was just a memory. But we know for a fact that the Mattel Marauders were used, and famously used, in the motion picture, The Green Berets.
Yep, with John Wayne.
John Wayne. It's easy to pick out. In fact, there's a scene where John Wayne picks one up and smashes it up against the tree with a line of dialogue about M16s and being flimsy, this old chestnut of gun mythology that never seems to go away. And there are screen caps of that moment in the film where you can see John Wayne holding it, and it is clearly a Mattel Marauder. It's clearly the toy. And I sympathize with their predicament in that when the movie was made, there were just no options for getting your hands on an M16.
Sure.
There was commercial production of the Colt SP1, and they were not exactly cheap, and they weren't all that common. The military needed all of the production because it was fighting the Vietnam War at the time. And the result was that for film purposes, the Mattel Marauder did just fine. So you see them in that movie. Now, the next piece of evidence that I have that pointed me toward unlocking this Da Vinci code of Mattel M16s was that at one point about a decade ago, I found this photograph on the internet, and it was from a website that a man posted who had been in the Special Forces and was in the Panama Canal Zone in 1967 and 1968. And he posted a photo of one of the troops in his unit, a sergeant in his unit, sitting in a day room holding very obviously a Mattel Marauder. And I've sent that photo to you. And that Mattel Marauder, which is so painfully recognizable, really confused me. And it was because, why would I see Special Forces troops in Panama in January 1968 with a Mattel Marauder?
Right.
This was kind of back in a time when the internet was, I think, a little bit more, a little simpler place than it is today, where individuals created websites and they posted their photos and they put their email address out. The world's kind of not like that anymore. But I reached out to the guy and he was very nice to respond. And my specific question was like, hey, man, in that photo, it looks like your guy is holding a Mattel Marauder. When he responded to me, he was like, oh, yeah, that's what we had several of those in the unit. And I was like, OK, why? Why did you have these? Right. What purpose could they serve? And his point was that at the time, we no longer had any M1 rifles or any M14 rifles. All we had were our M16s. Mm-hmm. And we periodically had to go off post for ceremonial purposes, for funeral detail, for parades, or for color guards. And the command was reluctant to let them off post with a machine gun.
No kidding.
So with unit budget, they went out and purchased Mattel Marauders. So that, yeah, and so they would, if they had to go off post, they would do that. And interestingly, I experienced this kind of cool parallel to this. Back in October, I was at the CMP, and the chief operating officer of the CMP, Mark Johnson, called me into his office to show me something he wanted me to try to help him figure out. And what he showed me were Springfield Armory Inc., Geneseo, Illinois, M1A rifles that had been unpacked from a crate that came from the Anniston Army Depot. Hmm. And the question was why and how and why. And Mark was interested in like, why would the Army buy commercial semi-autos?
Yeah.
I started to ask around, and a Marine friend of mine who was an officer said, oh yeah, we had those in our unit. We did that so that if people went off base to, you know, participate in a parade or do funeral detail or color guard, we could send them off base without having to let a machine gun go.
Because how about that?
So there were units that, using unit discretionary budgets, purchased semi-auto M14s so that that could go and happen. And in fact, when my father died in 2015, he had an Alabama National Guard honor guard at his funeral. Mm. And they fired the salute with Springfield Armory Inc. M1A rifles, semi-automatic only.
No kidding.
So there's a little bit of a tradition here. I'm not saying that this is conclusive proof about Mattel and M16s, but I'm saying that really supports the idea to a certain degree, this idea that in the 1960s, units reluctant to go out in public with a select fire firearm, they went and bought something that was the closest possible lookalike you could get your hands on. And that did the job just fine. Now, the fun part about this story is that it then leads ultimately to this latest nerd topic that I'm relentlessly researching, which is about the rubber duck. People are familiar with rubber duck rifles. And something that I've figured out is that the rubber duck of the M16A1, which is an item that in Army inventory was designated DVC T7, like device T7. And I believe the T stands for training. So training device model 7.
Okay.
The DVC T7, which is a rubber duck version of the M16A1, it first begins showing up in 83. I have not been able to document one that exists prior to 1983. And by documented, I mean photos of a DVC T7 or rubber duck M16A1 with a date prior to 1983. I think that the Army didn't create it until 1983, and that they were created at the, I think it's called the training aid Service Command, I think is what it was designated. That's even marked on the side of these DVC T7 rubber ducks. And what they were doing, they apparently were producing them at Fort Gordon, Georgia, which coincidentally was where I was born. But the rubber ducks, when they were produced, they were made using actual M16A1 barrels and front sight base.
Okay.
I believe that they were, and a lot of the research out there is suggesting that they were barrels that had reached the end of their service life. So they were no longer within operational specification. And so they were they were taken off of weapons because you know how M16s are. You take the upper off, that lower receiver can last forever.
Yeah.
In fact, there are still Colt Model 602s that were part of the Air Force contract that went into Air Force service before I was born that have just been upgraded to the M855 cartridge with the addition of an A2 or M4 type upper with new rifling. And those firearms continue to serve even now.
Wow.
Or in training commands, but they're still in service.
Sure.
Based on firearms that are approaching 60 years old now. Anyway, what they did is as these M16s were reaching the end of their service life, and if you think about it, by 1982, there were a lot of M16s out there that had high round count.
Yeah, sure.
And M16A1 production ends in 1967. I'm sorry, not 1967, in 1982. Yeah. The M16A1 is adopted in 67 and it reaches the end of production in 82. And with the end of production, there was an obvious service life extension program that was inaugurated so that they could take the existing rifle, and there were over a million of them, they take the existing rifles and replace whatever parts were necessary to keep the rifles in service. Mm-hmm. And they were finding that a very large number of them, the barrel was really the only component that was at the end of service life. So they pulled them. And rather than scrapping those barrels, the Army created this program to develop the DVC-T7, this rubber duck. And the DVC-T7 was not just there for ceremonial purposes, like funerals and color guards. It was also there to allow people to conduct bayonet training without using an actual select fire machine gun.
Right.
So that they use an original barrel, although it's embedded in this molded resin. And you can mount you can mount the M7 bayonet on it, and you can conduct bayonet training without actually having a firearm out there and taking the chance of damaging the firearm. And so the rubber duck is brought to life well after the end of our involvement in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I mention all of this specifically to support this idea of back in January 1968, which is when the photograph was taken of this special forces operator in the Panama Canal Zone holding a toy, there was no rubber duck. There was no other show in town.
Right.
If you wanted something that was ceremonially a drill rifle, there was nothing but the Mattel Marauder. And so what I believe is that definitely in the Panama Canal Zone, and maybe even in other places, there were arms rooms that had walls full of M16A1s made by Colt, Hydromatic, and Harrington and Richardson. And then they also probably had some toys in there too.
Wow. That's just... It's a lot to take in, and it's a lot to contemplate. And you know, and me listening to this story that you've just told us, it makes me stop and go, maybe I shouldn't have been so quick to dismiss the guy who was like, yeah, they handed me an M16 that said Mattel on it when I was in service. And so maybe they actually did. I mean,
maybe they actually did. They just weren't firearms. They were toys.
Right.
And you know, that's why I find the subject to be, it must be, and such on the other end of this conversation, it must really just read as the most pathetic nerd ever in the world. But I find the subject to be so thought provoking because at first, I was just a little arrogant and dismissive, like, oh, you're being absurd and ridiculous. Mattel never had anything to do with it. I've ranged now to where at first I was sort of cynical and condescending about whenever I would encounter this. And the really unfortunate part of that is that I encountered this from guys that were in combat in Vietnam.
Right.
And I just cannot be a person that questions what they say. And what I should be is a person that studies what they say. And at first I questioned. At first I was like, oh, come on. No, absolutely not. You're wrong. I was big on the whole you're wrong thing. And I've backed off of that a lot because I'm finding that no matter how much I learn about the subject, it's not going away.
Right.
To include exchanges that I've had with people during the last 6 months about whether or not Mattel made M16s during the fighting in Vietnam. And what I find more interesting about this is it's it's converted now into a, basically a meditation about philosophy for me. Because on the one hand, I am a big Cartesian skeptic in that, like René Descartes, this 17th century French mathematician and philosopher, he was the first person to identify that there were things existing in the spiritual and the temporal world could adhere to certain rules. He's the person that first came up with the idea of cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And two of the ideas that he developed as a part of his overall philosophy was that anything that actually exists can stand up to either rationalism or empiricism. And those two things can determine whether, can determine if something is philosophically truthful. And so on a rationalist, so I applied Cartesian logic to the Mattel Marauder. And on a rational level, I can say this. There is absolutely no proof whatsoever that the Mattel Toy Company at any point ever had a contract to make anything for the United States government, the end. And so on a rationalistic basis, I can say I've never found a single order form. There's no cage codes. There is absolutely no mention of any of this in any secondary source literature. There is absolutely no mention of any of this in primary source literature. And I remember 30 years ago, primary and secondary source literature was a lot harder to come by than it is now.
Sure.
It's low-hanging fruit. You barely have to reach for it to get your hands on it. Like I have a file on this laptop that's labeled M16A1 documents. That's just nothing but original documents about the production of the M16, the development of the M16, all of these topics. And that's something I didn't have 30 years ago. What I had 30 years ago was, what is that? Ezel's big, thick book on small arms of the world.
Yeah.
I had Ian Hogg. I had all these authors that I turned to, and they had nary a mention of Mattel making M16s. Now I have greater things at my fingertips, and there is absolutely nothing that proves that the Mattel M16 ever existed. So you can, I think, use that to disprove this idea, both through the rationalistic and the empirical. And so empirically, an important detail of this story is that no one has ever produced proof that it's ever existed. I realize that absence of evidence is not the same as the evidence of absence. They're not, you know, mutually exclusive.
Right.
And just because somebody can argue with me, and people often do, I'm using Cartesian logic. They're using Bigfoot logic. And Bigfoot logic is just because nobody's taken a photo doesn't mean it exists. And that defies ideas of Cartesian analysis, where there's no rational proof, there's no empirical proof.
Right.
And I used to kind of dwell on those ideas, like, show me the proof. And I still love the fact that for three decades of my life now, I've been encountering people that, and I think you've encountered the exact same thing. They're extremely forceful in
yes.
their opinion, in that they don't go, I think I saw one. Oh, well, I could be wrong. That's not how they portray it. When they portray it, it is argued almost to the point of argumentum ad hominem, meaning that, are you calling me a liar, you SOB? The argument, are you saying that I'm making things up? It becomes personal very quickly, and it becomes emotional in a way that I continue to find surprising.
Yeah.
And I'm now at the point where I think that is the more interesting aspect of studying the topic than me proving them wrong, which is where I used to be. And that's just a part of my natural state of insecurity that I'm trying to get over as a person. At any rate, if we can begin this process of like carving our way through the ad hominem attacks and the emotionality of this topic, that allows sort of the level head to prevail and get to what I think now is a theory that could potentially explain what's going on. And that's this theory of US Army units in the era before the rubber duck using toys as drill rifles.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. I tell you, when you said, are you calling me a liar? Man, that immediately takes me right back to the encounter that I had where I decided, okay, I'm not arguing it with these guys anymore, because I did have the, you know, guy comes up and it's the standard line, you know, when I was in, I was issued, and right on the side, it said Mattel, and, you know, and I tried to kind of laugh it off. I'm like, yeah, you know, the, a lot of guys thought the M16s were made like toys, you know, compared to the M14 or even to a Garand rifle, you know, just this toy must be made by Mattel. And he goes, no, it said Mattel right on the side. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I get it. A lot of guys thought they were toys. And he got pissy. So you call me a liar? Were you there? I'm like, oh, okay. Clearly this is, we are no longer in a rational world, and he's right. You know, I wasn't there, you know, so maybe he was issued a Marauder and used it on in some kind of a ceremonial, situation. Maybe he did. But I certainly wasn't there. And, you know, even though it's 50, 60 years ago, I mean, that's, war never goes away, and it's still a very real thing that these guys are living with every day. And far be it from me to go in and want to try to, for lack of a better term, to try to warp that worldview that they have created over the last five decades in their mind. I cannot break through to that. You know, we're not going to get through into that. And I think it will probably get a little easier in the coming years, in the next decade or two, to really be able to bring this logical argument that you have laid out and be able to present it to more people and have it be more easily accepted by more people as we, through the natural progression of time, lose more and more of the Vietnam generation. I think it'll become easier for people to accept the very well thought out and rational argument that you have for the existence of the Mattel M16. But that's a rational argument that we are not going to have in the emotional situation of dealing with war memories.
Right. And, you know, it just makes me think of two things. First of all, my father, when I began working at the gun store, and I began, that's really when I started to hear it a lot, when I worked at this gun store in Birmingham, Alabama, when I was in grad school. And I then asked my father, who did two tours of duty in Vietnam. His first tour was with M14, second tour, Cambodian incursion. The M14's gone by then, and he's using M16A1s. And so I asked him, I was like, hey, I keep hearing about these Mattel M16s. And he went, did Mattel make M16s? And I was like, well, you tell me.
Right.
And he was like, I don't know. And I was like, I think the only manufacturers were Harrington and Richardson, GM Hydromatic, and Colt. And he went, really? Was that who made them? And I was like, well, I have photos of you in combat with them. You tell me. And he was like, I never paid attention to my rifle. He didn't pay attention to who made them. I've got this great photograph of him on at Tontsenhut Air Force Base in 1967, and he has an M14 laying next to him, mm-hmm. and the M14 has an inventory tag attached to the flash suppressor, and I have that inventory tag still.
And oh, wow.
The weapon's laying on its side to where you can see it's got the selector lock. And later in life, I grew up around that photograph. And later in life, when I learned a little bit more about the M14, I was like, hey, Dad, so did you ever shoot them in full auto? And he was like, shoot what in full auto? I was like, M14s. He's like, M14s aren't full auto. They're semi-auto only. And I was like, no, they're select fire. And he's like, no. And he looked at me like, all right, son, shut it. I was the one in the Army, not you. And I was like, no, they were made as fully automatic rifles. And then eventually they introduced this selector lock so that you couldn't put it. And there were two types of selector lock, basically a switch and then a button. And he looked at me like, what are you talking about? I was like, you know that photo of you in 67? He was like, you can see the selector lock in the photo. And I showed him and he went, huh. And he wasn't as much of an obsessive gun type as I turned into. But he was in the Army for 22 years. He wasn't an infantry guy. He was a signal officer. Okay. That's not to suggest that he wouldn't know anything about firearms. It's just that those are matters that really did not latch into his brain. Sure. Just like things that happened to me when I was 19. I remember certain things very clearly and other things just I've forgotten about entirely. Sure. And so it, I think that's an important lesson that we can use as a template to explain a lot of these modernistic behaviors that we're seeing among, I've seen it from Vietnam veterans and even post-Vietnam veterans that claim the Mattel mythology. To go back to another point, At one point I was working for a museum in New Orleans, and we had like a public event, and we had firearms demonstrations as a part of that public event that were just blank firing demos. And I was very good friends with a number of the Marine officers at Marine Forces Reserve, which is a command that's in the New Orleans area. And so I reached out to a buddy of mine. I was like, hey, for this demo, we're doing a timeline. And I was wondering, do you think you could send out some Marines to do a blank fire with like an M16A2? And he said, oh yeah, sure, I'll go ahead. And he was a major, so he could make things like that happen for me. And he made it happen. And we had this event, this timeline, where we did a weapons demo, and these three Marines showed up for the weapons demo. And when three of them showed up, one of them was a sergeant, and he came up to me and introduced himself. And he was like, yeah, here, we're here for this weapons demo. And I was like, oh, so they sent three of you. And he was like, well, anytime one of the weapons from our arms room goes off base, there has to be two people with the weapon under arms at all times.
No kidding.
So no. And so there was a sergeant and a lance corporal, both of whom were carrying M9 pistols, and then a private with the M16A2 with a blank firing device and the magazine full of blanks. And when I asked them about that, he was like, oh yeah, nobody's allowed to go off base with just one weapon. There always has to be more than one of us. And they typically like to have two people, typically NCOs, there to protect whatever weapon or weapons go outside of the arms room. And I think back to that every now and then when I think of Mattel Marauders being used for parades in the Panama Canal Zone in January 1968. Yeah. Because if I was that unit commander, you bet your bottom dollar, I wouldn't want machine guns going off post unnecessarily. Sure. I can see why you would. And what I had asked for was not a color guard. I had asked for an M16A2 with blank firing adapter and blanks that could participate in a demonstration. And so they had to send a live weapon. They couldn't send a rubber duck.
Right.
And so that, to me, suddenly makes all of this Mattel noise make sense. And I think that's why the mythology and the legends survive today. And I have decided to make all of this worse by building a clone rifle that says Mattel, as you can clearly see.
Yep.
And I have even made a video that I'm going to post on April Fool's Day. I guess I just let the cat out of the bag, but whatever. And I did that. This is one of the many things that I've done to occupy my time during COVID-19 as a ghost gunner and getting things engraved. But just for the sake of the discussion, just because I have it and I wanted to show it, there's my actual original Colt M16A1 registered transferable.
Very cool. Well, here's my original M16A1, but you will see it is just chunks that I have JB welded back together that came from a Colorado weapons base. I've got another
sweet
chunked piece one here, and I've got another side plate, another piece here, another back piece.
Hey, do any of those pieces say Mattel on it?
Not yet. No, these actually all say Colt and they say M16A1 on them. So that's probably the closest I'll ever get to owning an M16A1 is having some chunks of one on my desk. But never say never, I guess. And one thing that this discussion has got me thinking about, and you know, for people who know me, you know that I've done historical reenacting and stuff in the past, and now I kind of want to put together a Vietnam era color guard armed with Mattel Marauders.
Wouldn't that be fun?
If the Marauders weren't $500 a piece on eBay, it might be a little easier to do.
Well, that's only really a part of the problem. And that's actually the easier part of the problem to solve. Now it's the uppers that are a nightmare now to get an actual M16A1 type upper. Like I'm running, that's two original Colt A Model 603 uppers right there, and I'll never let them go because I can't replace them. it's become extraordinarily difficult to get them. You're seeing a lot of the distributors and a company that are out there selling in 16 parts kits, and basically nobody's selling with barrels right now. Okay. There are companies make reproduction M16A1 type pencil barrels.
Yep.
So that you can find. That's why we really need Brownells to do another run of the retro rifles, because those Brownell retro rifles were awesome.
Yes.
I bought one of their full length A1 uppers, and it wasn't perfect, but man, it was great. And sure. I just worry that for Brownells, that was sort of a one shot, it's over now type deal. But basically everything that they made in that line was, they weren't like museum quality perfect, but they were great.
Right. And they were shooter grade guns.
They were right. And for things like color guard or reenactors, that was kind of the ideal thing. So you're not taking an original rifle or some early SP1 that you want a baby. You don't have to take those out in the field. But, you know, your idea would be great too, because like my father's funeral, it was terrific because he had originally entered Army service to the Alabama National Guard. The Alabama National Guard sent out a color guard and a rifle detail for his funeral. And not everybody can get that. Not every Vietnam veteran can get that. And I've often thought it would be super cool to have like a Vietnam veteran color guard that could fire salutes at funerals. And how meaningful that would be to say goodbye to a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah. And
that would be kind of cool to put that together. And then it would be a little bit spicy to have them all be Mattel and 16th. Just to acknowledge the existence of this strange scandal.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And we'll have to have just one guy tucked away in the middle with the legit Marauder toy in there, just to say that there is one guy fielding the toy just because, you know.
Yeah, you're killing me. All this talk makes me, I'm going to spend tonight now looking at eBay auctions for Mattel Marauders. The closest I've come to one is that I bought a full page advertisement for it.
Okay.
Which I will send it to you. But that's the most money I was willing to spend on one, because that was, the advertisement was $20. I am seeing Mattel Marauders going for $1,000 now. And
well,
I just can't bring myself to do it.
Well, the other day, less than a week ago from when we're recording this, I was on eBay and there's one on there, or was one on there for $500. So if I go on there a little later tonight and it's not there, I'll know where it went.
Yeah, that's right. Just look for my username and wait myself. You know, somebody has to preserve this history. And I'm so glad that we communicated about this, because this is kind of giving me the prodding that I need to write an article on the subject and look at the cool dynamics of things that we're talking about. We're talking about the persistence of memory. We're talking about the development of the DVC T7 rubber duck. We're talking about how with the adoption of the M16A1, we're kind of in this brave new world, because you don't need me to explain to you the weirdness that was the Army's adoption of the M16, which is a very bizarre and kind of complicated story.
Yeah.
And it was all kind of quick and it was bumpy, and the Army was focusing on things like getting over the ammunition problems that exhibited themselves in 68 and dealing with things like chrome lining barrels. They're still streamlining a weapon while it's also attempting to fight a war.
Yeah.
So they're definitely not worried. They're not troubling themselves with, we should put together some sort of a drill rifle. And there's an even greater history of this whole drill rifle idea, because I think you're probably familiar with the Paris Dunn. I know that the museum at your previous job had one, and that was that US Navy Mark I drill rifle that was, I sent you photos of mine. It looks like the 1903 rifle.
Right.
And it fascinates me because it was not adopted simply so that men could practice close order drill. And it was not adopted so that they had something non-lethal that could go off post with the color guard. The sight system that was put on the Paris Dunn Mark I's, it's the 1903 rifle's rear sight. And it was intended that you could give the troops that rifle, and then you could provide them with a course of instruction on the use of that rear sight, where you're introducing them to concepts like battle sight range and adjust sight range. Mm-hmm. And you're doing that with a toy, not really, I can't say that, but with a dummy rifle that right. cost the government about $3 when Remington 1903 rifles were costing the government 10 times that.
Right.
And so we've got this history that stretches back 80 years now of using some sort of a drill rifle that provides you with something non-lethal that can be used for training and can be used for ceremonial reasons as well. And it interests me very much that even now, if you go to the Daisy company that makes, they're famous for making air rifles. Yeah. Daisy makes a 1903 type drill rifle that the first time I saw it, it looked to me like an original 1903 A3 rifle, but it's not. It's a non-functioning rifle. It attaches nicely to this idea of I'm seeing more and more that drill teams and honor guards, when they go off post for public events, they're going off post and they're not carrying actual firearms. They're carrying, they're carrying deactivated drill rifles. Or there was an example that I encountered, which I think is pertinent to this discussion. It was in England. I was in England in 2013 for the dedication of a memorial. And it was a memorial to a U.S. Army unit. And the Army was requested to send a color guard, and the Army sent a color guard from one of the air. It was a color guard that came from an Army, I think from Vilsack in Germany, and they flew to one of the Air Force bases in England, and then they went to this event. Okay. And you're definitely not going to send them with M4 carbines, not with live M4 carbines. And I guess they just also didn't have rubber ducks. And so one thing that I am unfortunately beginning to see more and more is that somebody somewhere, I can't figure out who did it, but somebody made basically an all plastic copy of the M1 Garand rifle. Okay. And that's what I'm beginning to see a lot with color guards for these ceremonies in other countries.
Really?
Yeah. I've got some photos of those I can send to you to kind of document this.
Okay.
And that to me makes total sense. And further to that point, it makes total sense for me for Special Forces soldiers in the Panama Canal Zone. If they're going off post, they're not going off post into a city in the United States of America. They're in another country.
Right.
It makes sense for them not to be carrying, at least for a parade, it makes sense for them not to be carrying a live weapon.
Sure.
That's why, to me, when I found this one photograph, it all really began to make sense. And that these veterans that so spiritedly testify to us that they had Mattel M16s, they're not really all that wrong after all.
Yeah.
They had something, I think they might have had something that said Mattel. And then that with the passage of time, they've lost it. This is not to criticize them. This is not to point to them, accuse them of having dementia or anything. But my God, there are things about what I did when I was 19 that I don't remember at all. I remember every firearm and serial number that was around my world. But other things that I did, like I bought a car stereo with a cassette player and had it installed in my 79 Grand Prix when I was in high school. I can't to this day tell you who made that cassette player. But I went to a store, paid money for it, and then paid to have it installed. And it just isn't that important to me anymore. And these veterans testify about Mattel M16s. They carried a firearm as a part of their uniform service 50 years ago.
Right.
And like me with my cassette deck, they didn't pay attention. Or maybe they paid attention only enough to go, look at that. This thing was made by Mattel.
Right.
They did their duty. They served the country. They got out. And what they remember is that I had a gun that was made by Mattel, and I have to condition myself now to be less condescending about that, because I think the bigger story that we've laid out here this evening is the better story than the, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, old man.
Right.
I think it's a far better thing for us to have explored this topic using Cartesian logic.
Which is a phrase that I don't know I ever anticipated someone using on this show.
I'm using Cartesian ideas about the firearms world, because I find that the firearms world is a world that sometimes is a little lacking when it comes to empiricism.
Yes.
For example, if I could just throw one example at you.
Sure.
One of my favorite firearms is the M1 carbine. absolutely fantastic firearm. And I only own one. And why? Because the one I have is so perfect. Why should I have two? Anyway, I am to this day regularly encountering people who testify to the M1 carbine was weak and worthless. And the bullets bounced off of the jackets, the padded jackets that the Chinese used during the war in Korea, which you and I both understand to be an empirical falsehood. And I saw over M1 carbines bouncing off of padded Korean jackets. I'm applying Cartesian empiricism and rationalism. On the rationalism side, I'm like, why would the Army adopt a fire? Why would any military adopt a firearm that lacked penetrating power?
Right. Sure.
So from the rationalistic approach, I'm like, it doesn't make sense. It's a bit of a rational fallacy, which makes me believe that that these stories are wrong. Then from the empirical side, I have, using empiricism, using things that I can observe with my senses, I have proven that there ain't no way in hell a jacket is bouncing a 110 grain bullet going 1900 feet per second. Ain't no way, no matter how many layers of frozen clothing are on a dude, that bullet's going through. And that's the end of the story. And I find that fascinating because there's a cohort of people who, as a result of, maybe as a result of their time in service and their personal experiences, but also maybe just because they're repeating some scuttlebutt that they heard.
Sure.
But there's a cohort of people that believe the M1 carbine would bounce off of Chinese quilted jackets, when overwhelmingly the proof is that that is physically an impossibility.
Right.
But still people believe it. And so there again, another example of Cartesian skepticism applied to firearms history.
I love it. Absolutely love it.
I'm doing it more and more.
Nothing wrong with that. No. So here's a thinker for you. If you could meet any firearms designer, living or dead, who would it be and why?
John Moses Browning, final answer.
You don't need to phone a friend or poll the audience or
Browning to this day continues to boggle my mind. The things that that man created just in an analog era at a time when he was imagining possibilities. I find that because I'm at this point, I own not everything, but almost everything that Browning designed, particularly the automatic pistols, which I find to be the most impressive era of Browning's life, where Browning obviously was going, not every single year, but almost every other year, he's going, all right, well, how about this? Okay, well, how about that? Starting in 1899, basically.
Yeah.
And that what that man was imagining really speaks to a level of optimism. The idea that this man went, no, I can do it. That effectively a Mormon farmer from Ogden could sit down and create firearms legacies that long outlived him. I mean, I've been fortunate enough in life through work that I do for a certain association where I've got to spend some time at Fabrique Nationale in Herstal in Belgium. And I've been able to go into the room where Mr. Browning died. And I've gone there and I've kind of, you know, meditated over his legacy and the way that his life dealt with that company and changed the direction of that company and how it is continuing to change the direction of that company to where you can look at firearms that they're making even today. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them, certainly the M240 machine gun or the, you know, Mag 58 M240. You can see the spirit of John Browning is alive to this day in that firearm. And I find that to just be such an amazingly impressive thing. And I also just would love to like ask him questions about, you know, the moment when he was seeing dust kicked up below the muzzle of a rifle and he decided, well, maybe I could harness that.
Right.
That would lead ultimately to Potato Digger and then open the door for everything that's happened since. I'm kind of intrigued by all of that and intrigued too by the way that the pure quality of his designs were enough. They were such that other countries reached out to him and that the designs he made changed the direction of things that occurred after his death. Like just let's face it, a firearm that I admire a lot, which is the FAL, mm-hmm. that firearm is built on things that he designed. Dudonsev designed it, but Dudonsev had worked directly with Mr. Browning during his life, during yep. his trips to Herstal. And let's face it, the FAL is just a streamlined BAR. And then yeah. let's face it again, the MAG-58/M240 is a hybrid of BAR/FAL and 1919, which is taking us back to 1917 machine gun. And these designs that he came up with, I often describe them by using the P-51 analysis. And that is okay. that the P-51 basically took us to the apex of piston-driven aircraft technology. Once you get to P-51, what do the changes really look like? The changes are not revolutionary. The changes are more about material that go into the aircraft. The changes are more about other elements like what it can carry. And then really to get to the next level of evolution, you have to abandon piston-driven aircraft altogether and do something different in the form of jet power. Hmm. And the argument that I'm making, the P-51 argument that I'm making about John Browning, is that in this very early era of the metallic cartridge firing repeating firearm, he basically did everything in a very short period of time. Yeah. And we haven't really improved much on any of it.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just ask the 50 caliber machine gun. I mean, look at the modern 50s. When I was at FN at one point, I looked at the modern 50 production line, and it's the same firearm. The only difference now is that they have this kit that FN developed that is, you don't have to adjust head spacing and timing, and it allows you to remove barrels. And so that's a product improvement that John Browning right. didn't design. But everything behind that, everything in the receiver box is basically the same gun. Right. And it fascinates me that this person in the first blinking of this era when automatic firearms are being developed, in this brief window of time, he designed everything. It's yeah. basically within a 20-year period of time, everything we're using still today, he designed. Sure, you can say things like, oh, but look at the Styrog, or look at the F2000, or look at the G11. Are they really significantly different? And I don't know that they are. The big areas of innovation today are in the materials that go into the firearms and then right. into the sighting systems of the firearms.
Yeah. Yeah. Optics have been huge leaps and bounds, stuff that Browning could have never imagined, but anything that he could have imagined, he did imagine and then made it so.
And then made it so. Yeah. Like look at every pistol that's in your house right now and every pistol in this house, because I don't own anything that's older than 1899. Every pistol in this house he basically designed that pistol.
Yeah.
And yeah, sure, Beretta made some changes, and yeah, sure, you're seeing some design innovations, but like the 1911 A1. And I mean, I could even backtrack it from there because I'm a big fan of the FN Model 1910 pistol.
Yeah, I like it too.
Yeah, it's a great little pistol. It's enough to start a world war. But
yep.
The idea of the mainspring concentric around the barrel, that's design innovation that he was the first person to patent it. Yeah, you could say that there were other designers that were working toward that objective.
Right.
But Browning kind of beat everyone to the finish line on that. And how many guns do you disassemble regularly that are built with a concentric barrel mainspring?
All the ones that I can think of most recently.
I'm going to lose track real quick, but it's almost every pistol in this house at this stage.
Yeah.
And so that's why I would... For that reason and the other reasons that I've laid out here, that's why I'd love to meet John Browning.
Yeah, that's a solid choice.
Yeah, it's kind of like, of course you're going to choose that. I could have been a hipster and said something, you know, like there are times where, well, like I guess I could say this. There was at one point I got to meet James Sullivan, and I had a few minutes to ask James Sullivan some questions, and that was an amazing experience.
Yeah,
and James Sullivan. Just as much as Eugene Stoner, to me, they kind of go together.
Yep.
we can't, people tend to single out Stoner, and I mean, like, we really need to shove the two of them together. But I had moments to ask him a few questions, and I wish I'd had that same opportunity with John Moses Browning. It's just that he ran out of life a little bit sooner than I was born.
Yeah. Time marches on, right?
Marches on, yeah. If only I'd been born in about 1900, I would have been the right age to ask John Moses a couple of questions. But unfortunately, I was born 69 years after that.
Yeah, if time travel were possible, man, I'd be all over the place, just bouncing from time period to time period.
Well, then if that's what we're going to do, then it could kind of go back to Leonardo da Vinci at that point.
Well, yeah.
Wouldn't that be a fun conversation?
Oh, God, yeah. Awesome. Well, Marty, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule to come on the podcast and talk about the Mattel M16 myth. It's been a lot of fun, and I know that I now think about the entire concept of the Mattel M16 in a totally different way than I had before. So I appreciate you shedding some light on that, and definitely look forward to your further research with this project. And so thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. It was my pleasure. And isn't this an interesting little story?
It really is. A little story that seems to be getting bigger and bigger. Yeah. The more
we
know.
A story about a gun that never existed.
Yeah, imagine that. Awesome. Thanks so much, Marty. Have a great evening.
You too, Logan. Bye now.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the High Caliber History Podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please feel free to share it with someone else who you think also might enjoy it and give us a review. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode.